Ding, ding, ding. Listener-supported radio. See, I stole that shit from NPR. What's up, motherfuckers? I did not steal that from NPR. This is the QTR podcast, in case you were wondering if you were listening to NPR or not. The answer is, you are not. And my guest today will probably remind you of that as well. First and foremost, this podcast today simply doesn't happen without the support of my patrons. Patrons are people that sign on through Patreon and donate a monthly recurring sum to support the podcast. I'm going to shout out some of my patrons, then we're going to get rolling with today's interview. First and foremost, my friends over at the Sanglucci Steam Room. The Sanglucci Steam Room is a group of traders that I've known for 6 or 7 years. They are experts in monitoring what the options market does and how it may translate to moves in the equity market. They run the Steam Room, which is a room where basically they stay on top of shit all day, every day. They watch where the money is coming in the options market. They watch market flow. They spend the day reading tape, and they have offered two things to QTR podcast listeners, both of which are in the podcast description. First and foremost is their master course, so you can avoid all the mistakes that they've made over the years and learn only the good things that they've learned over the last decade since I've known these guys. It's actually probably been about 6 or 7 years since I've known them. They are also offering the 3LT playbook, which is their new playbook, the three rules that Sanglucci himself followed to become a seven-figure trader. And like I always say, I know him personally, so it's a true story. It's no bullshit YouTube or Facebook ad. Check that out. It's in the podcast description. This podcast is also brought to you by my friends over at The Trader's Path. The Trader's Path is a brand new day trading and investor advocacy and investor education service. If you're a day trader, you may want to check out The Trader's Path. It was started by a guy who got tired of bullshit nonsense day trading services following the quote-unquote gurus that you see on YouTube and on your Facebook ads, etc. And basically what he does, he provides a live stream all day as to what they're doing. They provide investor education. They provide daily watch lists. And they provide general insights into the market on a daily basis. So it's a great tool for day traders. Check it out, The Trader's Path, in my podcast description. This podcast also brought to you by my friends at Rumorhound. When you're talking about great tools to have if you're a day trader, Rumorhound comes to mind immediately. It's a brand new piece of AI-based proprietary software that is going to help you sift through the mergers and acquisition rumors that, as any day trader knows, you see on a daily basis. They pop up in your Twitter feed. They pop up in chat rooms. They pop up on CNBC. There's always M&A rumors floating around, and if you're a day trader, you know that. So what's the difficult part? Trying to distinguish which of these rumors are worth following and which ones may not be worth following. And that's where Rumorhound's AI-based proprietary software kicks in. It looks at everything from the financial viability of the deals to the credibility of the sources that the rumor has come in at. And it packages it up with a little recommendation for you to try to help you understand whether or not an M&A rumor is worth paying attention to. So check out Rumorhound. They are also in my podcast description. This podcast also brought to you by my friends over at Focused Compounding, which is a group of investors that focuses only on investments that are in the nooks and crannies of the market that normally people may not notice. They gun only for the things that are not on television, not in analyst reports, not on Twitter. New, unique ideas. Check them out. Focused Compounding. And on Twitter, at Focused Compound. Those links are in the podcast description. This podcast also brought to you by my friends over at Hella Bacon. These guys shoot machine guns out of helicopters in Texas. So if you're ever looking for a rootin' tootin' good time down in Texas, make sure you check out my boys over at Hella Bacon. Then go out, get some Budweiser cans, shotgun them, and smash them on your forehead when you're done. This podcast also brought to you by my friends at Corvus Gold, my biggest patrons that have been with me for a while, Piggly Wiggly, Russ Valenti, Matt Zimmer, Nicholas Parks, Nathan Michaud at Investors Underground and Traders for a Cause. I will be at that conference in early October. My friend Chris Bede, Ken R., and Chris Boas, and some of my newest patrons, Jakov Skarika, I appreciate you, Daryl Snow, Mark Howard, the storyteller, Cardwell Lynch is in the house, Erminasol Wotan has been here for a while, but I guess he just re-upped his donation. Thank you, my friend. Tony Doyle, my friend Adita Agarwal stuck with me, which I appreciate. Dr. Bernack is in the house, Jonathan A., and then some of my patrons that have been with the QTR podcast supporting me, bringing great content to you guys for a while. Well, I think it's great. I don't really care what anybody else thinks about it. My friends over at Verified Exchange are still with me. My buddy Bruno Gallo is in the house, and Rusty Morrison is still here, which I appreciate. My homeboy Matthew is still here. Shayevitz is in the house. Cynthia Yeager is still with me. DC Brown is still with me. Francis Cagney and Covefi Capital is still here, which I appreciate. Rob Lippich, I appreciate you, brother. I get your emails once in a while. I appreciate them. Agnes Dobo, thank you so much for your continued support. Rock that frog, you too. Finally, Rahul Desai, Scott Corsi, and Paul Marcotte. Thank you guys so much for being patrons. Two more rules and we're going to get this kicking. None of this is investment advice. Do your research elsewhere, fools. I am not an investment advisor. I'm not a registered anything. Ignore this. Don't follow my advice or my guest's advice, all right? As he'll tell you and I'll tell you, we're both batshit crazy, and that's all you need to know about that. Finally, I do encourage a 2-drink minimum for this podcast. I realize with my listeners, I don't have to go over that every single time because most of you guys are handling it without me, but every once in a while, I got to check in with you, make sure you guys are doing your job. All right. All right, with me on the line today is, I think much to his chagrin, too. I think he's been trying to avoid me because he doesn't want to come on too often, but I'm making him an honorary guest host, so I don't really care, is my dear friend and QTR podcast mainstay, David B. Collum, who is, I call him an economic commentator. I don't know if everybody else does in the mainstream, but certainly he is to me. He's a chemist, Betty R. Miller Professor of Chemistry and Chemical Biology at Cornell University, which is a small community college out in New York somewhere. Mr. Collum, how are you today, my friend?
I'm good. The official title is poser, so.
What do you mean?
Economic poser.
Economic poser, okay. Well, I'll update my notes here. So, what's new? How you been?
Oh, not much. You're the second podcast of the week. Well, actually, within a week. So, so the phone lines have been running a little hot, but that's okay.
What was the other one?
A guy named Jim Kunstler, who many years ago we connected up. He cut his chops. He's an author of about 15 books. And he started paying attention to the energy sector and you know, sort of oil supply. He's a peak oiler, which a lot of people laugh about, but I don't think he's wrong. I think it's just one of timing, as is true for so many things we talk about. But
right.
But in any event, you know, usually once or twice a year we do a podcast together. You know, I've met up with him and had dinner a couple times. And he's a very smart guy. You see him on Zero Hedge, actually. The counselor stuff will show up on Zero Hedge, and he's got this kind of laser sword like writing style, very florid writing style, which he shreds losers with. So he's a very entertaining guy.
Yeah, nothing going on in the oil world this week, so I can't imagine what you guys were talking about.
Yeah, boring as can be, right?
Always boring when the futures open on Sunday night and oil is up 15% or 20% or whatever it was after that attack on the Saudi Arabian oil refinery. Maybe you want to give me your thoughts on that. What do you think? I mean, the U.S. is saying that it was definitely Iran. Saudi Arabia's come out today and said that production looks like it's back online here, at least to some degree. Crude futures, I think, got as high as $63. And they come down to, looks like a 58 handle right now to end the day today. What were your thoughts on that? If you want to give me, I mean, sure, listen to the other podcast, everybody, but also, you know, what were your thoughts on that?
Well, in anything like that, I tend to not worry about geopolitical risk. If you look at the history of markets, even when big wars start, you know, the markets get all wiggy, and then you look up and you go, actually, they don't seem to give a damn. After all, I don't think they tend to get crushed when two sovereign states are bombing the hell out of each other for some reason. Anything in the Middle East, you should take it, you know, with a grain of salt. Someone blew up someone, you don't know. You know who got blown up, you don't know who did it. That's always true. And so, especially with something like drones, right? How do you identify who did it?
Right.
I have not a clue how you would. So. And there's always, you know, there's a number of people who'd like to, you know, cause trouble in the Middle East. That's not a secret. And so you don't know who did it.
There's a headline every day. You know, if you follow news wires and you have them all on push alerts and you see literally every press release and every headline that hits the Bloomberg terminal on a daily basis, there's not a day that goes by where there isn't a headline. Something explodes somewhere in the Middle East.
Right. And so I'm looking at the XLE right now just to see if forget the price of oil, if the oil providers give a damn. And it turns out that in the last 5 days, the XLE is up about 1.5%. So that tells me that although the price of oil moves around, the oil industry didn't even flinch. Flinch, but
do you own anything in the energy sector right now?
Yeah, I did. I have kind of an ugly story where I was an energy bull from 2001 or two, buying steadily the whole way up, and I did really well. And then I rode it all the way down, and it felt like it was sort of settling out. And somewhere around May of 2016, I looked at my Fidelity statement, which I didn't bother to look at because I knew what was in it. And there was nothing in it. And it turns out that Cornell had decided that so I felt that it had sort of bottomed. And, you know, commodities tend to do big retracements, so I figured the commodity stocks must too. And Cornell had decided they were going to go to more of a Happy Meal menu, and they sold out all my energy positions, and they had put me in life cycle funds. And I'm sure they sent me an email or sent me a package of crap, which I didn't read. And so I faced this odd situation where I'd white knuckled it to what felt like the bottom. And then I had to decide what to do. And so first thing I did is I undid their Happy Meal menu approach, which I can sign some papers and get back to being able to do whatever I want. That I did. But then I asked the question, should I go back into energy? And again, a rational investor would say, of course you do, because if you didn't think you should be in there now, why were you in there when they booted you, right?
Right.
But it also is one of these, okay, this is an excellent time to reevaluate too. It's one of those opportunity knocking moments. And so I sent out an email to about 6 hedge fund managers who I trust and said, explained what had just happened, and I basically asked, do you think it's smart to just re-enter the positions? And they all said no. And so I, you know, you could view that as contrarian, sure, now you should buy them, but I didn't ask these guys for contrarian opinions. And so I camped on cash, right? I got out of the life cycle funds and went to sort of fixed income type stuff. But I camped on the cash. I've been watching it for many moons now, and I haven't paid for that kind of patience. So most of my Fidelity Energy funds are down from the day that they liquidated them. And so I haven't paid, and I didn't like getting booted, but now I'm at the point I'm waiting for a recession. When it comes time to sell, everything sells, right? When you need to raise cash for redemptions or whatever, and ETFs start liquidating and stuff like that, which I think all of which is going to happen at some point at the end of the cycle, and the cycle's already old. So, you know, it seems like my patience is not going to have to be that good. I'm making a list and checking it twice and trying to decide what I'm going to buy when there is pain and suffering. And the energy will probably be on that.
Yeah, I think the prospect of this being an indicator of more potential volatility in the Middle East is far more interesting than buying on crude futures moving higher, because this event is only a temporary restriction. You know, these guys are hustling to try and get production back online. So I was reading stuff over the last couple of days. People are like, oh, now it's time to re-enter energy. It's time to get back into that sector because of this. And I'm like, all right, you know, but this is an aberration. You know, this will be corrected over the next, you know, however long it takes them, 4 weeks or 5 weeks, they're saying, to get everything back online. But I think the angle of it adding volatility from a geopolitical standpoint is more worth looking at from an investment standpoint, because now you have Trump kind of on the trigger, and we don't really know what's going to happen with Iran. I was reading today Iran declined, I think, our request to speak to them, unless we were going to come to the table with an idea of how to lessen sanctions on them. It's like, So fuck
well,
you guys,
that
right?
makes sense to me. If I was a rock, that's what I'd do, right?
Well, of course.
Why would I speak to you if there were sanctions all over me? The other thing is, again, I always discover what it is I didn't know, you know, years after I didn't know it. And so I was a natural gas bull, for example, and I knew they were credit sensitive, but I didn't fully appreciate that they were not just credit sensitive. The entire fracking industry is basically built on a credit bubble. And right. I didn't fully grasp that. And so I got to figure there's maybe going to be a washout in that world that's pretty serious in the next downturn. And I was, you know, investing with sort of my eyes half closed, not realizing it. That's a recurring theme for me. But they can, those stocks contribute. You know, I had more than a decade from 2000 forward of 13% a year, and they contributed to that. It was a phenomenally nice window for me while everyone else was getting killed. And then of course they made me pay. But so I'm just waiting. I think the people who are trying to dip buy, and they say, oh, there's value out there, and I go, you know, if you buy some stock because it's got a PE of 10, you might be forgetting about the fact that in the downturn it can go to a PE of 5.
Right, because the E goes down too.
Yeah, and the economy goes down and everything just goes wrong, and again, people sell what they can, not what they want to. And
right.
So, you know, if WeWork IPO shares are not selling that day, you sell your Procter & Gamble. And so when you have a, you know, Black Friday sale, everything is on sale. And I'm at this point, I've just resigned myself to waiting for a real earnest buying opportunity, the kind where, you know, Hussman comes out and says, you know, we're pulling out our hedges a bit, right?
Right.
And I'm dying to see what Twitter looks like in a big downturn. You know, it's going to be so much fun. It's going to be such a blast to watch Twitter in a downturn. And then the question is, how constructive will it be when I think there's buying opportunities? And you know, who will I be listening to?
Right.
You know, will we be chattering about, look, you know, I'd be buying zero coupon bonds or whatever? You know, it seems unlikely, of course, but Twitter could be a fun place, because right now it's filled with people wailing about how it's the end of the cycle, what do I do? And people saying, no, the cycle's going on 20 years, and I think they're wrong. So, it's kind of boring in that sense. There's nothing to be gleaned from it in terms of investment advice that's going to knock me off of my position right now.
Well, I want to see, it's been probably 10 years. Actually, not even. It's been probably 8 years. I'm going to see when I joined Twitter. I think I joined Twitter in 2013. I joined in, May 2013. So I'm going on 6.5 years now that I've been on Twitter, all of which we've seen the market just go up. And I remember writing, you know, when the Dow was at 15, 16,000, how I thought things were just getting a little crazy, getting a little out of hand. And I'm with you. You can call me sick, you can call me, you know, whatever, but I want to see what Twitter looks like when the tide really does go out, because we haven't seen that, not since I've been on FinTwit. I mean, and if it's any indication, when we have these 500 or 1,000 point down days in the market, if that's a microcosm of what we're going to see when we see a real 10, 15, 25% correction in the broader markets, I can't wait.
Oh, you're an optimist. I think, you know, how about 50?
Oh, I would love it. I would
right.
love it.
And well, but and then it's going to be it's also going to be socially tricky, because there's going to be people on Twitter who are in great pain.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so it's, you don't want to be, you know, dancing in the street and howling and bragging. You know, I occasionally do that now because there's no victims yet.
Sure.
Right? So if the market drops 900 points, I'll go out there and say, "Hey, this is kind of fun, right? Gold's up and the market's down. You know, I'm going to enjoy today." Because there's no suffering, right? If they're suffering on a 900 down point day off of, you know, Dow, what is it, 30,000, then they're going to be on suicide watch if we get a real downturn.
Yeah, well, you're exactly right. And there is suffering on 900 point down days, which is why the whole thing, it's just further proof. I mean, our Treasury Secretary called the banks after the markets moved down 5% or 10% or whatever it was heading into Christmas last year. So
yeah, I mean, Mnuchin, you know, what a doofus.
There's definite suffering on these, you know, minus 900 point days. People act like it's
well,
the end of the world.
So that gets back to the, what was Mnuchin looking at? And at first it was like, oh my God, the market dropped 16% and the Secretary of Treasury loses his shit. What does that mean? Right? What kind of crazy? This guy's an ex-Goldman guy. How can he be such a pansy, right?
No,
but what was missing from that story, and a lot of people didn't see, and maybe they know it now. I always think everyone knows everything because it's, you know, all over Twitter, and I go, yeah, actually people don't because they're not such Twitter hounds. But the leveraged loan market had seized up for about a month, a little over a month.
Right.
So they saw a frozen credit market. So I don't think it was the market going down that freaked them out. I think it was the credit market seizing up.
Well, then you go and you, I don't know. I think he could have dealt with that with a little bit more decorum than he did, but it'll look, it would be interesting to see what happened if we saw a move twice as big or three times as big. And certainly you don't want to see suffering. You don't want to see people get hurt. And this is, you know, one of the reasons that I wanted to do the podcast to begin with is because I felt like the everyday kind of mom and pop investor is standing in front of this freight train and it's coming down the tracks and they don't know. Not only do they not know how to get out of the way, they don't even know that they're standing there to begin with. They think everything is firmly intact and the government and the Fed has everything under control. And, you know, I think raising awareness that that might not be the case is the first step.
Well, so there's a number of sort of presumptions based on, you know, what recency bias. It's always cool to use neuropsych terms to try to show how smart you are. The recency bias or just the fact you can't remember past 10 years ago. that some things will always work the way they do. And it reminds me when I was a kid, you know, when you're a kid and you're 5 years old, you think that the way the world is at that moment is the way it's always been because
right.
Your entire memory is only about 3 years. And so people think, for example, the assumption is that the Fed has it under control. That's a preposterous assumption, in my opinion. The Fed will let it go when they can't hold it up. I think they think that it always V bounces. There's nothing that says that has to be the case. Japan is always the example that the bears like to point to. I think that the one I've been obsessing over, you've probably seen it, I've been obsessing over the bond market. The bond market no longer represents a market in which the prices reflect a revenue stream. And so I put out a tweet the other day and I said, look, you know, treasuries, you know, 30-year treasuries at 1.9%, which someone corrected me and said they're 2.37. And I said, yeah, a month ago they were 1.9, so shoot me. And 30-year treasuries 1.9% in no way, shape, or form reflect people's willingness to buy a 30-year stream of income.
Right.
Right? That if you said buy a treasury, hang on to it for 30 years, what's the interest rate you want to get? The answer is not 1.9%. So the treasury price, a.k.a. the yield, in no way reflects anyone's opinion about 30 years of revenue. Right. It's just and the question that I ask is, look, I get it. When did this market become unmoored? Because at one point, a 30-year treasury reflected people's perception of future inflation plus some added return. And there's no, as I said the other day in my tweet, I said, anyone who thinks that 1.9% is the correct answer for that has got a big fat tumor. And I'm positive there's no one who would sign off for 30 years of 1.9%. And everyone says, oh, but, you know, buy a treasury to hang on to it. And I go, okay, so what you're saying is they're Pokemon cards now. You're day trading. And I know there's insurance companies that offset liabilities and assets and all that crap that I don't really understand, but I can kind of say some of the words. And I get that part, but it's now dominated the treasuries. And so now, let's say you're Joe Sixpack. What are your choices? You buy a treasury. You buy short-term treasury, which means who knows what. You got to buy it again soon, but it's the best buy, in my opinion. You buy long-term treasury, which might get you approximately the same yield, but at least you have that yield that holds up. but it holds up. And then, you know, if we get a rout in the treasuries, all of a sudden you've just lost all of your return plus a lot more. And so there's huge risk in buying a treasury and not knowing how you're going to exit,
right,
if it's a long-term treasury. And so you could buy a treasury bond fund, which will lose huge amounts of money if there's an unexpected rise in interest rates. I don't mean unexpected like, you know, next Thursday. I mean unexpected like we start marching up and a couple of years from now we're sitting at 5%. And you get crushed. All that yield that you reached for is going to go away. And so what does a Joe Sixpack investor do for fixed income? When it's priced like this, you cannot buy, as Joe Sixpack, a 30-year treasury at 2%, let's call it, just round it up. And then say, and I'm going to sell it because Joe Sixpack has no idea how to trade a bond. Right? Not a clue how to trade a bond. And if they think they do, they got the big fat tumor. And so they're going to get crushed by the real bond traders, the guys who do know, and the guys who can wag the dog, right? The guys who can move it like crazy. And so Joe Sixpack has no choices. They have precisely zero choices. Bond fund, great risk. Bonds, great risk. What do you buy, right? Argentinian bonds, corporate junk bonds from Europe. What do you buy? There's nothing. I would love, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to set up a fund that we collect local money and we invest in local businesses, and I'm going to call it a savings and loan. What do you do? I don't know. So I'm laddering, you know, to your bonds. I've got a TIA account, which I can pull out of in a heartbeat, so they say, that returns 3.4%. And the reason it pays so high is because most of the people in this fund can't pull out. And as a consequence, they can invest in longer term stuff that's illiquid, but they don't need to worry about it because the to close out your account takes 10 years. You do 10% of it a year for 10 years. And that's how you get rid of it.
So you there? You mentioned WeWork, the IPO, before, and it was on my list of things that I wanted to ask you about. I kind of wanted to know whether or not you thought the valuation getting trounced here for the proposed, for those that don't know, WeWork was supposed to IPO recently, and they were supposed to do it for a valuation that was up to $47 billion.
That's the number.
Now it's looking as though the market, not the public market, but the behind-the-scenes market has revalued the company to the tune of a $30 billion haircut to somewhere in the $15 billion range, which, by the way, you don't need to be an economist to understand. That's a big fucking difference, and can really make a profound impact on your plans for the future. They're saying today now that they may consider doing an IPO again in October at the much lower valuation. Do you think that the market kind of taking this IPO and puking it back to the company and saying, hey, basically, you know, go fly a kite, you think that's a sign? You think that's an inflection point?
Well, that's it. So it could be, I think what you're describing is the Bear Stearns internal hedge fund moment, where it starts out as just kind of a side story, a side play. Oh,
right.
Cares about WeWork IPO. I have mixed emotions about WeWork in the sense that when you actually hear the description of the company, you go, here's these guys who get this big commercial real estate and they rent out space to entrepreneurs, and you go, that's fosters capitalism. And then on the other hand, it appears as though the founder and CEO is a complete crook, sort of Elizabeth Holmes level crook potentially. And so it looks like good idea, wrong guy, don't touch it, right? And so it could be one of those triggers, one of those, you know, someone sneezed and the avalanche finally decided to let go moments.
Right.
It could just be something that the market is able to patch up and make go away and bring out some more stupid ideas to do IPOs with. And there's no way to know. There's no, you know, when a market's not a stable, the proximate trigger that actually causes the snowflake that causes the avalanche, you just don't know which one it's going to be. You know, the famous one is the Babson break in the 1929, where Babson gave a speech and said the market's overpriced, and then the market crashed. But Babson had been giving that speech for 4 years, and no one listened to him. And so, if you're going to give the speech, every month for 4 years, yeah, you're going to time it perfectly on one of those speeches. So I don't know. The other thing I read the other day, which is true, but I hadn't seen someone say it, that the awareness of market overvaluation is usually pretty profound before the market breaks, and so the idea that you won't see it coming is not correct. And I was reading Fed minutes from 1927, I think. in which the head of the Fed was, I'm trying to remember, one of the ex-presidents. Who was it, Garfield? Which one got shot, McKinley or Garfield?
Whichever one
didn't get shot, the other one. The one who didn't get shot. And he was the head of the New York Fed. And he gave a speech, and he talked all about the overvaluation. He was very careful parsing his words. But he was saying, we're up in the nosebleed section. This is a problem.
Right. I mean, do you think that still holds true now, though?
Well, so in the dot-com bubble, everyone knew it was a problem, right? And not everyone. There were idiots who didn't. But anyone who understood how to value equities knew it, except for Bullard. He claims he spots these things. He's an idiot. And then the real estate bubble was huge, and I know the Fed didn't see it, and I know a lot of people didn't see it, but there are thousands who did. So you could read, any article you want, and you can trace articles back to 2000, 1998, saying we're starting to get a subprime. We're starting to put in too much subprime mortgages into the system, right? And so these bubbles are not surprises to many, many people. It's a surprise how long they stay inflated. But when it's time to go, it's time to go. I think the Fed will be like, everyone thinks they're Superman standing out of the mountain holding it up.
Do you think we even have a clue that we're overextended now? I mean, going back to just think about the last 5 years. You had Janet Yellen basically say 30% ago that equities were overvalued. You had Carl Icahn came out and released that huge video. I don't know if you remember that, but Carl Icahn did a PR campaign one day where he came out and was warning people the market has overextended itself. And, we've chewed up Yellen and spit her out, and now we're on to Powell. And Icahn's message fell on deaf ears, but for the day that it happened. And, I mean, it's obvious to people that are paying attention that the market is overextended, but do you really think people are even close to realizing it now? I mean, do you think you can hold it in the fucking face of these people, like Tom Lee on CNBC, and tell him, certainty, here it is, overvalued, and that it's somehow something's going to click in that guy's brain and he's going to realize it?
No, he's not. But, the market was above fair value, which doesn't mean it's a bubble, doesn't mean you shouldn't buy it, right? If fair value gives you a good return over time, then above fair value means you get an okay return over time. But it was above fair value by 2010. And some could, you can by some metrics say that it was below fair value for about a month and a half. And so by 2010, it had already crept up above that historic long-term trend line.
Right.
And various valuation metrics show it. There's dozens of them that show that. And so the mistake that I know I made was I felt that you couldn't go through such a monstrous bubble and then regress back to just fair value and then take off again.
Right.
Historically, that was, if you define the mean by long-term historic metrics, you have to spend half your time above and half your time below it. Not time-wise, but statistically weighted, you have to spend half above and half below. I think I learned that back in probably sixth grade. And so if you just regress to the mean, then you're either going to redefine the mean or you're not done. And so I've told this 100 times on podcasts, my biggest mistake in 2009, I started buying in 2009, I was in cash, and I started buying in 2009 But I didn't buy aggressively out of greed. And that is, it was not a fear. It was out of greed, because I said, this thing's got to go. This thing's got to rip the soul out of this generation of investors. I was wrong on that. So I have, 10 years of being wrong. I couldn't have seen the interventions coming. I've asked people if they saw these interventions coming. I said, do you know anyone who wrote about these interventions of this magnitude? Did anyone predict this, right? The famous person said, look, before we're done, the central banks are going to put in trillions. No one wrote about that. I can't find a single article, single blog, you name it. So that was the black swan, is that the central banks would lose their shit so badly that they would do things which are sort of against all logic. Now, the bulls say, well, aren't they geniuses? And I go, yeah, wait till you see the bar tab, right? We haven't paid the bill yet. And so if the next – my thesis is the next recession is going to do it. And if the next recession comes and goes and they can sort of pull it out again in the same way, I'm just dead wrong. It also may be that we're in a period of vast – we're going to spend a period of vast overvaluation, which still means lower on average returns, because if you're overpaying for stuff, you're by definition, unless the economy starts growing at 7%, you're not going to get a great return. And to those who don't know this, over the last, I think it's 8 years or something, the economy grew 30% while the equity market grew 300%. Those two are supposed to correlate, right? So you got a factor of 10 misbehavior on the part of equities. They say, well, that's because they're so cheap. They weren't cheap. That's the problem. It's a factor of 10 coming off of a bottom that was never really well established. And a real bottom, it's painful. It's protracted. And so I think the assumptions that are wrong potentially going forward are that the gross miscalculations by the 20 somethings on Wall Street are going to be that that this will go on forever. That of course is not
right.
True. That the Fed can save us. That of course is not true. That when it happens, it'll be a V-bounce. So you just ride it out. That's
right.
That's the one that's debatable. But I think that won't happen. I think the next one's going to be more Japan-like, and I think we're going to bounce along the bottom, and potentially capital gains are going to be a loser bet. And so then the question is, what do you invest in? And that the answer to that question is, you invest in stocks that pay you to hold them, not appreciate. They pay you to hold them, and so it's got to be dividends. It's got to be companies that have cash flow. And they're not going to be story stocks. So it's not going to be Netflix going deeply into debt.
Right.
It's not going to be that kind of crap. It's going to be whatever it is that just churns out cash. It could include Amazon or something for all I know. It could include Microsoft, although right now they're nuts, right? They've got to do some serious correcting. But it's got to be a company that, McDonald's is crazy now, right? Holy cow, how do you blow McDonald's up into a bubble? But they kind of have. And you say, well, it's got a P of 30, which means you're getting 3.25%, 3.33%, right? Something like that. And that seems low to me. But they've also got a vast amount of debt. And so their share price might reflect the fact that the balance sheet's PE is not the number. It could be that the debt that's gonna be the problem. I don't know.
Sure, yeah, and McDonald's one of those companies that, it went through some operational issues some years back, and instead of really solving them, I mean, they rolled out All Day Breakfast, which was a nice PR stunt.
It was brilliant. No, All Day. Oh, yeah, but the breakfast originally was brilliant.
But the point is, really the crux of what they did when they changed CEOs was just implement a huge buyback. And
right, and if they're $40 billion in debt to do the buyback, that's a problem. Right.
Well, it's not a problem now, but it's going to be a problem, right?
Well, it's a problem. It means you're getting a misread. You're getting a misread on the share price, because when you put a guaranteed buyer underneath the share price, right, then the shares seem to do this relentless march upward when in fact they should be adjusting.
And then all you need to do is take that thought process behind McDonald's and extrapolate that across pretty much every stock that's out there, because almost all, if you look at the major corporations, the S&P 500 corporations, you know, the Dow Industrials, the corporations that make up the major indices that are, you know, the main mega caps that the markets kind of are gauged using, they all are levered, all of them.
Well, they're also levered in a funny way that a lot of people don't know, and that is, you know, we know about municipal pension funds that are hosed.
Oh boy.
It turns out some of these mega companies like Intel and Procter & Gamble and stuff like that, they are decidedly underfunded pensions too. So at some point the market drops. Now the pensions are way underfunded. Now they got to get serious, right? Now they, you know, and for pensions to be underfunded after a 300% gain, this is criminal.
Only bad roads ahead after that, right?
Yeah, only bad roads ahead. So now the market drops, and so now they really have to top off the pensions, which means therefore their earnings have to drop. And so now you've got this feedback loop going on, and so this is why I see dead people, right?
And these municipal pension funds, they don't have any fucking brilliant ideas. They're only, you know, the big idea that I've seen from municipal pension funds over the last 2 years has been issue bonds and try to make a carry trade, right? Issue bonds,
right,
take that money and try to put
in
it
equities
in the market. Right, exactly.
Exactly. So that's just more leverage, right?
Well, it's just ridiculous. And you're like,
actually,
to
the
your
other
point,
thing
they're doing it after a 300% rally is ostensibly
right,
the worst possible time to do that.
Yeah, they're the dumb money. These are municipal pension fund managers who are notorious idiots sometimes, right? The Orange County guy, the Robert Citron was his name, I think. And so you've got the amateurs who are using leverage to try to bail themselves out of a hopeless situation. And so I think the munis are going to get saved by some government bailout. They'll lend them the money the way you lend your kids money, right? And you go, oh yeah, they'll pay me back. Sure. And so I think there'll be a kind of an MMT moment for the munis. But that could produce inflation scares. Everyone thinks inflation's gone. Now, forget about the fact I don't believe the numbers anyways, and the fact that, you know, inflation is a problem when the quality of goods you're buying sucks, salty balls. Inflation's a problem when when the assets are going up, right? All those things are inflation. But the other thing is that inflation can just show up. It's a mindset too.
Right.
And so and they talk about, you know, how, you know, workers haven't gotten a raise. Well, if workers are getting a raise, guess what? That's inflation. And all of a sudden company earnings are going to start plummeting if workers start getting paid. And if they don't start getting paid, they're going to goddamn burn down the place. So it's a paradoxical situation. So I think workers do need a raise. They haven't gotten one above inflation in decades. And then the companies won't earn much money. And so everything keeps coming back to lack of balance in the system.
Yeah, and it's all kind of coming to a head at once, right?
Yeah, I think so. And it feels like it's towards the end. Now, it has felt that way for so long that I'm a broken record that's been playing an infinite loop for years. But it's hard to imagine that we'll look up 3 years from now and it's still going.
Right. 3 years. 3 years.
It could be
I agree with
minutes.
You.
Well, it could be 15 minutes.
It could,
I don't know.
But when you put a time frame like 3 years out there and just think about where we are now, how precarious things are with, you know, what the Fed is expected to do here again with cutting rates again. Now they're intervening in the repo. They just today, well, last night they I think intervened because the repo rate went to like 10% last night.
Yeah, I saw that.
And then a headline just hit while we were on that they plan on intervening again tonight.
So how do they intervene? What's the intervention?
I don't really understand the mechanics of how it works, but to the best of my understanding, how the repo rate works is what it is people that are looking for like super ultra quick, like ultra secured loans essentially against maybe trades that haven't settled or something. And I think the Fed injects liquidity. And so as banks are less and less eager to allocate those lines of capital to people that are waiting, I believe it's mostly on trade settlements. Don't quote me on any of this, because
So here's the problem. What you just described is QE, which they have done all through the years.
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying.
The difference is QE, as we call it, QE, is a methodical, relentless kind of intervention, whereas what you're describing is the short-term little adrenaline shots. This is like taking an insulin shot for a diabetic, right? Yeah. And so I saw the repo rate spiked. I know just enough about that to know that that would cause the Fed sphincter muscles to tighten.
Right.
and the interesting question is, I think there's in theory a lot of reserves tucked away in the system. So what is causing that? I don't know. And maybe someone out there in the Twitter sphere knows and can tell us. But you know, that's the kind of the crack in the chink in the armor. They could say, oh, look at that, you know. I always like to cite back in 2007, I think it was, March of 2007, where the market ABX index, which was this arcane index tracking, CDS pricing or something. And I didn't know what it was, but I knew that all of a sudden it went from being flat as a pancake for years, and it started marching downward and seeking alpha, and various people were saying, watch that go, that's the credit market breaking. And so I didn't know what it was, but it was like a thermometer on the wall, and you could see it starting to march down, and I believed their story, and it turned out to be true. So, you know, repo rate could be some sort of tightening that they're not going to tell us about until they think they've fixed it. And then they'll say, okay, here's what had happened. We weren't going to tell you, but now it's okay.
It
blows the hell up.
It's just another way of fixing interest rates, right? I mean, if that rate spikes, it spikes for a reason. Whether that reason is somebody scratched his ass the wrong way in an office somewhere.
Well, it could be a bank being in trouble, right?
Right. Very
true. One bank.
Very true.
Right? Could be Saxo. What is it? Saxo Bank? Who did the WeWork IPO?
But the point is, it's happening. It's happening for a reason. The market is making it happen for a reason.
Right. Who did the WeWork IPO? Which bank?
I don't know.
Was it Saxo Bank? But they had to shove a lot more money into WeWork, and I think the people, their shares sold off. Maybe their debt sold off too, because they were injecting money into WeWork, and it was looking, going, you know, WeWork is, who was it? Galloway said he was using the symbol WEWTF for WeWork, and so it could be something as simple as that you got one bank that's under stress,
right?
But it could be the beginning of something very large, right? Again, the internal hedge funds at Bear Stearns, when they went, were said to be something like $600 million losses. I mean, these were stupid level losses that were announced. When they first got announced, it was really downplayed. And all of a sudden, they started turning into billions, and you go, oh, they were fibbing, weren't they? So, yeah, they'd never do that.
I saw on your Twitter that you had listened to the Whitney Webb podcast I did a couple of days ago twice. Is that accurate?
Creeped the shit out of me.
Did it? Yeah, me too. Yeah. A little bit. Me too. What did you think?
Well, so I listened to the first one twice, and then I listened to the second one. It's too much info to process.
Right.
Now, but there is kind of a take-home lesson, and that is that it reinforced an opinion I had formed that you mentioned in the podcast that we had talked about it, and that we joked about how Epstein was going to end up dead.
Right.
And then a couple weeks later he was dead.
Right.
Or not. But what Whitney Webb did, and I found her very convincing. I think if she's listening to this, this is not meant to be an insult, but there's some learning thing there, some ADHD or something. She's very energetic.
Yeah, well, she's
very
just,
energetic.
You can tell she can't get the stuff out of her head fast enough.
Yeah, she darts from topic to topic. You can see that she's creeped out. She's scrambling to put it all together too.
Right.
But so it's like Whitney is putting together this big jigsaw puzzle about what the Epstein scandal means. and she's making connections like you would on a jigsaw puzzle where you go, okay, I got a piece of the silo, I got a piece of the cloud, I got the corner pieces, you know, but it's not yet a complete picture.
Right.
But, and she seems to be able to keep track of what she knows and what she just suspects, and she seems to be able to keep track of the difference between a connection and a dirty connection.
Right.
And anyone who hasn't listened to these two podcasts, you really ought to listen, because you will come out of the end of those two podcasts, which I did see, you got a big count off those two podcasts, that the Epstein scandal, I think, years ago, a guy named Peter Dale Scott used to write about stuff like this, and he used to talk about how every once in a while a window opens up, you get a quick view of the pipes underneath the surface. You get a view of the dark side of politics, not the douchebags, you know, talking in Congress,
right,
but rather the guys who are running the world, running the country. And he used to write about, he wrote about the drug cartels, very scholarly work, phenomenally scholarly work. He really tried to make sure he got all his facts straight. And in any event, so he referred to these sort of flashes where once in a while the window would open up and you'd peek and you go, oh my God, right? It's like the glass bottom boat over the Great Barrier Reef. You look down, you go, holy shit, look at all those fish. The Epstein scandal seems to be one of those windows that flashed wide open.
Right.
And you know, as we talked about, it reminds me of the Panama Papers a little bit, where we got this quick flash and there were 25,000 people with accounts with this law firm in Panama that were all obviously a very dirty, dirty thing. And then it just went away. So they're able to close the window very quickly. The Epstein scandal looks much, much, much bigger to me. And almost to the point where I'm wondering if I can keep my attention on it because it looks hopelessly big. And so it's as though I was peering inside the windows or something of the warehouse where they had put the Lost Ark. And someone finally opened the door and I looked and I go, holy shit, I can't explore this place.
Right.
And so Whitney's doing that for us. And the connections she's making are staggering. And I had done a podcast last week with Jim Kunstler, and we talked about it. And he asked me a question which was he got to that I'd been thinking about. And that is, he says, can you connect up the mass shootings with Epstein? Because the Epstein story looks like a unified conspiracy theory. It looks like this grand conspiracy, like Einstein's unified theory of everything that he was trying to put. That's what the Epstein scandal looks like to me. And I said, no, I've been looking for it, though, because there's something about the shootings that bothered me, the same thing that got us booted off YouTube. By the way, I wouldn't bother to put this one on YouTube now. and then I'm listening to Whitney, and she made the connection.
Right.
And I go, so I sent Kunstler an email with the two links and said, dude, you asked me, I didn't have a good answer. Here's the answer 3 days later. And the connection was that there's a vast series of software companies that will make huge profits and huge gains, intelligence gains, by releasing a nationwide 411 number. And it all gets very spooky and it gets dangerous. So I'm going to say this, but it's going under such thin ice, but it traces back to the Mossad always. Now, I can't think of a worse thing to do than to point to Israel and say they're the problem, but I just did. And so these software companies and Israel has a fantastic tech industry. But what I think it is it's an intelligence-based tech industry. And so you mentioned all these names in the podcast, and all these different companies are going to make a ton of money and be able to insert software into a nationwide network if they use the shootings, which is what she drew together on this, if they use the shootings as a reason to embed in their software AI that allows them to anticipate shootings. And Trump has already talked about that. She's not lying about that. Trump has talked about using AI to anticipate shootings And when you start talking about embedding AI technology into nationwide things, you're going, boy, if there's not an intelligence group behind that, I would be shocked. And so that connected the shootings with the Epstein scandal, because the Epstein scandal is all about intelligence. It's all about the CIA, Mossad, whatever.
Now, the interesting thing is I went back and listened to 131, which is our episode the last time that you were on. And that was the one, obviously, that got banned from YouTube. I think it got banned from YouTube because of the Las Vegas stuff, not because of this.
I think so. Yeah, I think so.
But here's what I'll say. You know, you made a lot of very cogent points about the connection between him and intelligence that, you know, first off, he was alive when we talked, right? So it was a little bit less right. of a little bit less of a conspiracy theory now.
Yeah, we were laughing about it.
Yeah,
then.
We were laughing like, hey, this guy could turn up missing. And it's like, sure as fuck, the guy turns up missing.
But I think
right?
we did say he's not going to court.
Right. But like, now you look at it, and I guess the point I'm trying to make is you touched on a lot of things that I think she picked up with and really brought that ball forward. So for people that thought that, you know, even myself included, when we recorded that, I called that episode the conspiracy theory episode because I thought right. a little bit was that, you know, and here we are. So what I got to do is just make a list of all the things that you claimed in that episode and all the things that you find interesting. And I'm just going to start crossing them off as they happen. That's what I'm going to do. And then when they all happen, I'm going to go back to YouTube and say, hey, just an FYI.
Nah, I wouldn't even bother. So the YouTube episode being banned had no effect on me whatsoever. I didn't care. Bothered the hell out of you. The article in Zero Hedge wasn't even a problem, except the headline that says Dave Collum gets booted off YouTube for hate speech. I'm going, oh, my dean's going to love that headline, right? So just a reminder, I actually have an employer, right? And I do not want them to get mad at me, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm not afraid to speak my mind, but when Colin booted for hate speech is in a headline of an article, then I get a little creeped out. So the Epstein story, though, the problem is from when we recorded that podcast to now, and there's guys who've been paying attention to this the whole way. They must know so much. But the magnitude of it exploded after that, and it was big then, but it's gotten bigger now, and I don't know how. Do you know if Whitney was working on her stories for years, or did she just do it that fast?
No, I think she had been working on it before, because it was a 4-part series, so she definitely.
Right, but when did she start?
Oh, I'm not sure. I could. Let me see. I have her actually her site up right here because I was looking at her stuff.
Well, it's probably not sort of real time on a podcast, what she presented in her 4-part series and in her 2 hours of podcast, and she's doing interviews by the gazillions.
Yeah, she is.
But
rightfully
your two
so.
Very long podcasts covered a lot of territory. It was an enormous volume of information.
Yeah, she was writing she was writing about Epstein back in July.
But that's nothing. I know how long it takes to put together a complex story like that.
Sure.
That's nothing. So if she put it, she's superhuman. Now, here's the thing about her story. She's very specific. And so when she says, here's a company that does this and the board of directors is occupied by these 5 guys, you can look that up. Now, she gave us so much information that I can't look it all up and check it. But her facts are all checkable. And if they really hold up, then, you know, when Ehud Barak is running all these tech companies, you go, there's something so fishy. And I don't need more detail to know that when there was a former prime minister or former head of war or whatever, I don't need to know exactly how it's working to know that
right.
that guy running a bunch of Silicon Valley companies is a problem.
Right. And you literally, especially on the last podcast, you could pause it every 5 or 10 seconds and have a new thread to pull on with that podcast with her, because she was coming out with names and connections and locations and this and that and the other. Every sentence you could spend 10 minutes unpackaging every single sentence that she came out with during that podcast.
Remember,
it was so concentrated.
In my podcast, when I think it was with you, where we started laughing about what if Pizzagate is true?
Right.
I think it was in that podcast. And then I'm watching a Cheryl Atkinson talk at the Hillsdale College. Cheryl Atkinson is beyond reproach. She's super, super high level, and she's really I read her books. You know, she's phenomenal, highly respected. And I'm watching this podcast, and she's talking about David Brock, one of these political hitmen, the Roger Stone, the David Brock, the Paul Manafort type people, the Roy Cohen type people who destroy people as a profession. Right, she says David Brock's boyfriend owned the pizza parlor, and I'm going, holy moly! Did that just bring it back into the game? And I couldn't stop laughing because I'm going, you know, and when you find out that all these connections, people who are not supposed to be connected, and she's pulling the connections together. And you know, the various players are pulling these connections together. At some point, you go, there's just too many of these to just be a coincidence.
Yeah, but do you think it's going to matter? I mean, don't you feel like this is kind of already past?
Well, so I talked to my wife about it after I finished the second podcast of hers, of Whitney Webb's. So I'd listened to the first one twice, and then the second one I listened to. And I said to my wife, I said, I think it's game over. Because whatever it is, I think it's here to stay. This is not, in the very least, this sort of web of connections is the Italian mafia. And supposedly we brought them down, so maybe. But in the very least, the web of connections is the Italian mafia equivalent. And at the same time, this web of connections includes people in the highest branches of government, in the highest branches of judicial system,
right,
in the highest branches of the media. So the Italian mafia didn't have that. And so this looks like an undefeatable system. It looks like where the world is heading. And then the question is, has it always been there and we're just getting an occasional view of it?
Right, right.
And if so, it's actually say, okay, whatever. That makes it actually a little better because, you know, the world didn't come to an end if it existed before. It actually is a case for the small government guys. So, and I've said this before years ago, when government was 3% of the so-called economy, you know, when 3% of our workforce worked for the government, they could be corrupt as hell and it didn't matter. But when 50% of the workforce is somehow paid for by the government, now it matters.
Right.
And so you can have Tammany Hall. It doesn't matter. You can have all these corrupt things. I found out one of my wife's relatives from the past, Alonzo Cornell, was tied in with all sorts of crooked guys back in the late 19th century. And I told her about it. She thought that was funny. But again, this is small potatoes. This is where you're getting favors from union bosses and crap like that. But now you've got cases like you got climate debates and stuff, and they're talking about trillions of dollars. And the money's too big, the connections are too vast. And so then the question is that the massive growth in this government that we have, which Jonah Goldberg does a great, great job of pulling the magnitude of that together in his latest book, is it so big now that it's kind of a stage four cancer? And I just don't know.
Yeah, I mean, and that would be the only thing that I think that would keep it on people's minds because it has run its course in the mainstream media. When Epstein, you know, died or we were told that he died.
Yeah, it didn't have to run its course, but the mainstream media has. So the other thing Whitney said, we're kind of like doing a post-game analysis. It's like the NFL today or something, right? Whitney made an interesting comment. She said that unlike all the other things that she's looked at, that after the Epstein suicide, let's call it that for whatever it is, we've already talked, we can talk about, you know, whether he died or not, and if so, how. But she mentioned that after normal cases, the media immediately has this sort of synchronous storyline that they go to. And that in that case, the media was shooting in every random direction. She said it kind of creeped her out because she said she's never seen that where the media seemed to be not even knowing what to say.
Right, right.
And then it was sort of noticeable because you had prominent guys taking guesses and stuff instead of saying now they've got it under control. So the Epstein story is now he's a perv, and only he's a perv. You know, once in a while someone will mention Clinton being a perv. There's a newsflash, and and that he's now dead, and the story's over, and we should pay off his victims,
right?
And we should probably punish the guards for blowing it.
And that's a wrap.
And that's a wrap.
Well, you make a good point, because that was one of the things that stuck out. That was the first podcast since you mentioned that, because I mentioned also I went downstairs and turned on CNN, and they had some woman who was a representative of the prison system in some regard and trying to make sense of it all. How does this happen? And she didn't.
Well,
she didn't even have a narrative, Dave. She didn't even have a narrative. She said, "Well, you know, it shouldn't have happened. It always happens. Well, there's no way it should have happened." She was all over the place. Just to your point of the media didn't really seem to know which direction to go with it.
So I talked to a prison guard, and he said, "No way." He said, "No way." He said, "No way" in a number of the things. He says the suicide, no way. He said the cameras being broken and staying broken, no way. He said even in the jail we were at, he said, camera breaks, we fix it right away. And he says there's no way the Epstein thing is legit. And so, but no one needs to be convinced of that. Where the media's got control of the plot line right now is that everything's localized. So, okay, so someone got in there and killed him. People can even live with that. But what they're containing is the who. They're containing the story about the pervs, which there seems to be countless pervs. They're totally containing the connection with the Mossad, with CIA, and with the various intelligence. And they're containing the connection between inside the Beltway, the media, Hollywood, the Weinstein type guys, the church. That all gets connected. And in fact, the connection with the church was the cardinal, who's in a world of trouble with the church. The guy was like at the center of the frenzy. I can't remember his name. There's pictures of him with Roy Cohn. And Roy Cohn was sort of Epstein's predecessor.
Right.
And so by the time – this is where I'm at, though, where I go, okay, this story's so big that it's like I've got this inkling of some fundamental change in the laws of physics, but I don't have the skills to do it. I'm not a physicist, but I have the insight, but I don't have the abilities. And so I'm trying to figure out whether you just say let it go, or whether to keep pursuing it.
Well, I think there's going to be a subsect of people that are going to continue to pursue it no matter what. The only question is, you know, how long will they be marginalized?
Here's a question I've been pondering a lot, okay? So the Epstein case is not polarizing to the extent that everyone uniformly agrees it's screwed up, right? I think most people don't understand how screwed up, but they agree it's screwed up. And I don't want to go down the 9/11 rabbit hole again. I looked at the videos you told me to watch. They're very compelling. And I've seen some more stuff since, and so it's a good story. The new Pearl Harbor? A very good story. But here's the question I've been trying to answer. So, and again, I'm going to mention 9/11 only as a vehicle, and that is that you have one slice of society that looks at towers that fall that seem to defy the laws of physics, and they say that's impossible. Then when they're asked to confront then what happened, they're able to wrap their brains around the I don't know, but it had to be done by nefarious forces, right? So they're able to get their brains around the idea that not knowing how they fell doesn't mean that they're wrong about them falling.
Right.
The other slice of society, equally smart people, one would argue, look at the assumptions required to bring the towers down, and they say you'd have to have this huge force. How would you wire them? How would you bring them down? How would you fake it? You know, how would you keep the secret? The whole thing. And they say that's impossible, and therefore they overlook the things like the building shouldn't have fallen, overlook the fact that the Pentagon, you know, was hit by something besides the plane. They overlook that. And the question is that I've been trying to get at is, what is it about the two personalities that causes people to go to one camp or the other? Because both camps really have to wrap their brains around something that is perceived to be impossible and say, okay, I'm calling that possible.
Right.
Both camps, and they're just looking at two impossibilities. It's this gigantic paradox, And one camp says the buildings couldn't have come down that way, and the other camp says you couldn't have brought them down. And so they both have to wrap their brains around and entertain an impossibility for their story to fit together. What is it that causes people to choose what personality trait? I'm going to talk to a psychologist about this. I'm going to find someone over in the psych department, or I'll go visit Cass Sunstein at Harvard. that's a joke. He's a douche. I actually was on a PhD thesis of a guy who wrote about conspiracy theories, not in this weird way, but he really went through the literature and stuff. And I may call him. And I'm not going to mention by name because I don't know if he wants it out there or not. But he was a former potential congressman for Texas. He was a prominent guy. I met up with him. Very rational guy. Very, very, you know, articulate and thoughtful. He owns his own business, and he is so intrigued by all this stuff. But I would like to know how do people choose one of these two sides of what seems to me to be a paradox?
Yeah, it's a great question.
I think the truthers.
It's a Rorschach test in some.
Exactly. But here's where there's a difference. I think the truthers understand the magnitude of what they have to accept as not impossible.
Right.
Right. So as you and I watch the towers come down, and we don't believe them. We have to accept the fact that that's a pretty weird demo, no matter how you cut it. It's pretty weird that they pulled it off, and it's pretty weird that they got the guys in there, and who set it up, and how did all this happen? The deniers, I don't think, have that realization. And that is they don't need to because they're sitting on the story. At our side of the story and they say they're just idiots.
Right. Well, that's exactly what happens. They don't need to because they're sitting on the story that's been given. It's very convenient for them. They don't have to employ.
But I'm trying not to actually say one side's smarter than the other. That's really key.
And you know what? That's a good way to look at it because I would bet part of it from the other side is willful ignorance. I would bet part of it is lack of capacity to understand to some degree. I mean, and it's not about who's smarter and who isn't smarter. And just to say, to speak to what you're talking about before, I mean, when it comes to this topic, I was telling Whitney Webb, you know, I don't even focus on anything but seven. That's it. And I just start there and I just focus on the one, you know. Of course, there's all this circumstantial evidence, all these things that we've talked about, but I just focus...
But what you're focusing on is your impossibility, and they're focusing on their impossibility.
Well, no.
See, that's the weird thing. So they say it's impossible that Building 7 could have been rigged to come down.
Right.
And you're saying it's impossible that it could have come down without being rigged. Now, I do...
No, that's...
I happen to be on one of the two teams, right?
That's... Yeah, I guess you are kind of making a good point. But I try to keep it as simple as possible.
Well, here's the simpler analog, and that is there are two types in society which describe what I just described. And that is there's those who seem to be comfortable entertaining conspiracies that at times get wiggy.
Right.
And those who are not. And so you will never hear me say I'm not a conspiracy theorist, right? You know why. I am a conspiracy theorist. And then the question is, and that this I think is true. It's I think the conspiracy theorists are a way more open-minded group, possibly to their detriment, right? I think the guys who wanted to charge Area 51 or whatever, I think once you entertain crazy ideas, you can go down a lot of rabbit holes like a crazy person, and I have a friend who's a very smart guy who goes down rabbit holes I wouldn't consider going down. But I think to be a natural conspiracy guy, a person who comfortably says Epstein's case is so screwed up or 9/11 is so screwed up, there's a personality trait. I think you have to be more open-minded. I think the ones who say I'm not a conspiracy theorist and therefore that's baloney, then I think that group wants a tidy world.
Well,
they want a simple world.
I look at this akin to kind of how you would look at an investment, right? Like, I wouldn't say that it's impossible that 7 came down due to fire. I would just, you know, because impossible means there's 100% certainty that that's not what happened. And I don't think that would accurately represent my position. You know, my position would probably be more like, I think there's a 5% chance that that happened or whatever. But I look at that the same way I would look at it.
But you don't, do you? But you're being generous, though.
No, I'm not. I'm trying.
You really think there's a 5% chance?
I'm
trying to put the number at 5?
I'm trying to honestly tell you what. Yeah, I think probably I would say less than 5% chance.
Right.
It's the same reason I look at asymmetric trades and don't say there's no risk. You know,
so I never would say a 95% probable thing makes the 5% impossible. When I say, you know, if I ever say, look, it's impossible for this to happen, I got to be over 99.
Yeah, well, I hear impossible as 100.
Well, but impossible is never 100. It's an asymptotic limit. But
fair enough.
Right?
I mean, but we got to talk about the definition. I mean, impossible means not possible.
Right.
It doesn't mean that there's a 0.00001% chance of it happening.
You still add the phrase "in my opinion" at the end of that sentence. It's like adding between the sheets for a fortune cookie. You know, you still have to add "in my opinion" at the end of the sentence.
Yeah.
Right? You say it's impossible in my opinion.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I guess you're right in that regard. You think, I mean, look, let me divert you off this topic for a second because there is one more thing I want to ask
timing.
You about. I know. Well, we can stay on it if you want. I'm not trying
That's the thing I wanted to cover. I wanted to cover the idea of the seeming impossible paradox and what causes people to choose one of the two sides. And it's not a symmetric choice.
Right.
It's a personal – it's something about who you are. It's the Rorschach test. You nailed it.
Yeah, and if I wanted to accurately describe my position, I would be much more – I would be much more accurate in saying, I think that it's something that is, you know, way worthy of being investigated again and, you know, objectively than saying, oh, it definitely happened from this or it definitely happened from that. But to me, there's something that just doesn't line up there, you know, that just doesn't connect to me.
And the reason the asymmetry comes in is that I don't think the other team does that.
I agree.
I don't think they say you could be right, but I don't think so.
Oh, they definitely.
They say you're an idiot.
Correct.
And so that's where the asymmetry is.
Yeah, or you're a nut. And
you're a nut, and there's no chance, and you're just blowing hot air. And that to me is that's a kind of a boneheadedness, because they're not acknowledging the lack of 100% confidence either.
Well, I think with any conspiracy theory, too, it's easy for that side to do that and just say, hey, like, we're being the skeptics. Oftentimes they can point to conspiracy theories that are, you know, theories that me and you would say are impossible, alternate theories that me and you, you know, would say are impossible, that, you know, UFOs came down and, you know, shot the towers with a death ray or whatever, you know. And we
actually
would be like,
someone said something great. They said, does it really seem possible that someone could, some organism could cross the vast expanse of the galaxy and show up on Earth and simply leave crop circles? Did I ever give you my model of why we'll never invent a time machine?
Yes. Yeah, we did that on the last one.
Okay.
Yeah. But
yeah,
you know, most of the crop circles, that's a great one.
And then just leave a crop circle. It's like, no, I think they'd probably hang around and make
contact. Yeah, they would fuck something up a little bit more than that, right?
And they always seem to land in Iowa or something.
Well, you know, all of those crop circles, almost all of them have been debunked as hoaxes, right?
Well, of course they have.
Okay, all right.
Not being left by alien spaceships.
Well, yeah, man, I guarantee you there's people out there right now in the
no,
mid-
I know there
Midwest
are. And they just
off.
Hung up on our podcast.
Exactly, yep. You guys had me. You had me with Epstein. You had me with 9/11. But you guys are way
but
off
see,
base
I wouldn't,
with crop circles.
I wouldn't. I think they're wrong, but I wouldn't belittle them for wanting to track it down. I wouldn't belittle a person for trying to track down Yetis.
Right.
I wouldn't belittle, but part of it's because this belief that generally that there is a lot of chicanery in the world.
Sure.
Right? People invented language to lie to each other. Right. And so I think someone who's trying to find out where these lies are has got to get some credit. no matter how ridiculous they think the lies are. I think you have to say yes, but, you know, without those guys, no one's going to question. One time a guy published a paper that seemed to defy the laws of physics, and at the end of the experiment, it didn't work. Someone did a follow-up paper, and they said, you know, every once in a while it's good to challenge the laws of physics, which was very insulting, actually. But at some level, it's like, oh, I defend bubbles. You want my defense of a equity bubble, a credit bubble? Every once in a while, it's constructive, I think, to flood the market with so much goddamn money so that every stupid cockamamie idea possible gets tried. Because every once in a while, I think it's a ripe time for ridiculous ideas to be thrown out there to brainstorm and to not have credit constraints shut them down, because some of those are going to be brilliant.
That's a very good point.
Right. So out of those crazy bubbles came Amazon, and out of those crazy bubbles came Oracle,
and a million corpses of companies.
Right, but that's a price.
Right.
So I remember even back during the dot-com bubble, when I realized it was a bubble, I said, yeah, but from these companies, there will be some monsters. We will not be left with zero after this.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, the tide goes out. There's one or two swimmers still standing, and everybody else just washes up on shore.
I refuse to use that metaphor.
All right. My brain is not as fantastical as yours.
I had a tweet stream where I started, where I said overused metaphors and similes, and people started posting all the ones that drive them nuts, money on the sidelines, all sorts of stuff. We had quite a stream of crap on Twitter. It was really kind of fun. I was kind of glad it went viral.
Yeah, any of those, like, you hear on the golf course, you know, people out doing business trying to get a deal done.
Oh, you know, I wish I had a buck for every time I heard someone or read someone say that history doesn't repeat but it rhymes. I'm going, oh, that was so clever. How did you ever think of that one? I invent my own metaphors, if at all possible. They're colorful, they're grisly, but I try to invent them. I try to let spontaneity generate them.
That's a noble undertaking. Let me ask you a question. Is there anybody in this? We were talking before we jumped on the recording, joking about one of the Democratic candidates. Anybody in that Democratic field doing anything for you? How you feeling about?
You mean besides Tulsi getting taken by in the barn and buried in a shallow grave? That one.
What is that about?
Well, she's anti-military, right?
Right. And she's in the military.
Well, the military is a multi-trillion-dollar industry. You really think they're going to let her get near the White House?
Yeah. No, I don't.
Right, that's easy stuff. Put it this way. I would not want to defend the argument that they would knowingly let her get near the White House.
Right.
Right? And the only way, if she had gotten near the White House, I would say, therefore, her anti-military stance is fake. If she's legitimately anti-military, she was guaranteed to be taken out.
You think that she's putting on a facade, in other words.
So here's what I think. I think this push for these Justice Democrats, these super progressive crowd that are trying to take over the government, and this is true. This is not a conspiracy. It's AOC and what's her name and Omar, what's her name, and there's another who I never remember. I think it's possible.
Oh, what's her face? Rasheeda Tlaib, Ilhan Omar.
Yeah, I know. AOC and the Jets.
Right. Okay. There you go.
But I have this funny feeling Andrew Yang is one of them.
Oh, well, what do you mean a funny feeling? He's trying to give everybody $1,000 a month.
Yeah, I have a feeling he's kind of coming in sheep's clothing as an MMT-er, though.
What do you mean? Of course he is.
Well, he's a free shit guy, but free shit and MMT, there's still a decimal point separating.
Yeah, but they come from the same cloth.
Well, they're all free shit, though.
Right.
Every last one of them's free shit.
He's coming in sheep's clothing.
Actually, another viral treat I put out there was the 10 Democratic talking points, and about every third one I had more free shit.
Right.
Donald Trump sucks, you know, more free shit. And so, I think the Democrats are underwhelming. I wouldn't want to be, I wouldn't want to get the nomination. So if I were Kamala Harris or if I were Pete whatever his name is.
Mayor Pete.
Mayor Pete. Yeah, that's good. Mayor Pete. I wouldn't want the nomination. I would want to put up a good showing and be the odds-on favorite for 2024.
Right.
And so I think they could all be playing to show,
you think,
not to win.
You think any of the Democrats have a chance against Trump?
It'll depend on how things play out from here. It's up to Trump, right? So it's up to Trump and the economy. So if the Democrats can talk us into a recession, or if it just happens on its own volition, and we're in a raging catastrophe and the farmers are getting crushed and things, and then Trump could lose it. But I'm not convinced the farmers are going to vote for those Democrats. So circumstance could cause Trump to lose, but I think it's his to lose in some sense.
Yeah, well, and the media has certainly blitzed us with enough of those stories of one after the other after the other. I just read one on Bloomberg 2 weeks ago about...
I like that Ramirez, swab in the face story. Boy, what a farce that was. So the story came out the New York Times wrote about and to sort of attack Kavanaugh. That yet another person stepped forward.
Right.
And they forgot to mention several things. One is that there's three actually. One is that the book was written by the guy who Kavanaugh went nose to nose against in the Lewinsky affair. So they forgot to mention that it was an archenemy of Kavanaugh.
Okay.
Who wrote the book? The second thing they forgot to mention is that Ramirez, through her friends, articulated that she doesn't remember at all. And then the claim was that, and the New York Times editor defending themselves the next day did a question and answer, and they said, but this was new information. It was not new information. I went back and dug out a 2017 article that was exactly what the article said.
Oh, yeah, they had been talking about this already.
Right. So this wasn't anything new whatsoever. And so what happened was is then the New York Times 24 hours later did a retraction or a correction. 24 hours on a political timescale is nothing.
Right.
Right. And so meanwhile, Kamala, I hope she never gets elected. Harris, she's still talking about impeaching him because of this, impeaching Kavanaugh because of this new story. And she's ignoring the fact that this story's fake.
Right. Well,
it doesn't help that Kavanaugh's got a smirky grin.
No, it doesn't. And it may not be fake, but it's not new.
No, it's not new.
I mean, they were talking about this when Blasey Ford was doing her testimony. There was news of a second accuser that had come out.
Oh, there's a bunch of accusers, and a lot of them folded like a cheap suit. I don't know what that metaphor means, actually. Who folds suits? Yeah, a lot of them fell apart. They looked like syringes in my Pepsi crowd and the Pepsi generation. But that's the kind of crap the media's throwing out. The media is such garbage. It's just the one thing Trump's right about is that the media is just appalling. So his war against the media, I think, in some sense, was completely valid, and his war against CNN was completely valid.
I think the war on CNN, I think, was best kind of justified in that exchange with Acosta that one day where, he's standing up all indignant and Trump says, I've answered your question, and he's still standing there and the aide comes over and she's like, hey, he said what he's going to say. So what are you going to do? You going to stand there and hold the fucking microphone anyways and just try to cause a sense? At this point, he's not saying anything else. He's the president. So he says what he wants to say and what he doesn't want to say, whether you agree with it or not. And now we got to move on. And it turns into this, give me the mic. And they're tugging at the mic with each other. I mean, that, I think, is a good example of just how little bit out of line it has gotten with some of the media, specifically CNN. I mean, I don't know. It's difficult for me to turn on CNN and not see them going after. What I do is I take inventory of the news channels when I want to watch the news. So I'll look at Fox News, I'll look at CNN, I'll look at MSNBC, especially when an event breaks, because I want to see who's covering what and who's saying it which way. I did this with Epstein. I did this with a couple of the mass shootings. I wanted to see how each outlet was carrying it. And
I used to switch around. Hold on.
My point is, I can't remember once turning on CNN and seeing them covering anything that Trump has done favorably. Anything.
Yeah. Yeah. I used to, so when I was, when we were going through the election cycle, when it was all the Republicans going against each other, I would listen to left-wing radio and left-wing television because they would do the best job at beating the crap out of everybody.
Right.
so their analyses were the most cutting.
Right.
And then when it went to Trump versus Hillary, I switched over to Fox News because they were the most balanced. Why? Because Fox certainly leans right, I'm told, but they hated Trump too.
Right, exactly.
And so Fox was most likely to find somewhere in that happy medium. Then they signed off on Trump and they became, you know, Trump supporters, and now they're out there doing the whole bullshit.
Yeah, it was really Hannity, wasn't it, that signed them up?
Hannity,
for Trump.
And he took grief. So Hannity gave Trump the time of day. It was nothing more than that. Tranny just had him on a show and talked to him and let him have, you know, airtime. And he got so much crap. I remember listening to him saying, look, I just gave him the time of day, guys. Back right. off on his show. He was talking about that. Right. So it was clear that he was being told by the Republican elite, don't help Trump. And that was coming from Billy Crystal and George Will. Excuse me. You know, what's that all about?
And those early interviews with Trump after he got elected with Hannity, you know, Hannity's not really – he's not sniffing his throne. He's just – treating him as the president. I mean, and
right.
being respectful. Yeah, he's kissing his ass a little bit, as you know, probably anybody would with the president. But I mean, more than not, it just seems like he's just being respectful and just treating him as the president. And that,
well, the other interesting thing to notice is how the evolution of Trump being treated as president versus Trump. So for the first few months, It was not, none of the media treated him like president.
Right.
He got no presidential treatment. It was always, you know, that scumbag. And over time now they talk about him in a language that's more familiar with the president. And I guess as I look forward, you ask, can any of them beat him? They're so pathetic looking. And for you guys who are left wing, who don't want to hear that, they're not more pathetic looking than the Republicans were going against Trump.
Right.
They were pathetic too, right?
They certainly were.
We've got 350 million people and we find two dozen people who look that bad.
Well, it was a disaster. The Republicans that ran against Trump, it was a disaster. And that's why he massacred them. I mean, between Ben Carson, okay, who just couldn't, you know, we look at the fruit salad of people's lives. Remember that comment? And
yeah.
You know, Ted Cruz,
oh,
who has
yeah.
this smarmy kind of waiter at a French restaurant vibe to him that won't stop reading the fucking specials to you,
and then
even if you order.
Bush. Glass jaw, Jeb, you know, and
please,
oh, it's just awful.
Please so, clap, you know.
So the Republicans stunk, and then so here's the question that I asked people. I said, okay, so you guys think Trump's gonna lose? I don't run into many people who think he's gonna lose, even Democrats,
right?
And I think the problem is that if you ask the question, which demographic voted for him that won't now? And I can't identify one. People say, oh, the farmers. I think, do you really think that farmer out there who maybe got hurt by the tariffs and stuff, do you really think, you think they're going to go way left?
Yeah, they're not
sure going to
fucking
that?
Swing Nebraska either, you know?
Right. And then the question is, okay, which demographic could vote for Trump? And the never Trumpers could. The Never Trumper was a big group,
right?
because I totally understood the idea that the idea of pulling a lever for Trump required some sort of Hail Mary,
right?
and so as a consequence, those guys didn't pull for Trump. They voted for who? They voted right in vote for, you know, Oprah or something, and that group is going to be able to look at Trump and say, look, he did a lot of battles. A lot of them turned out to be fake. He's been up against a wall of media.
Right.
The world hasn't spun off his axis. We're not in thermonuclear war.
Right.
Many of them will be able to justify the battles with China as long as they don't get worse. Right? And so all of a sudden they're going to say, you know, I can pull the lever for this guy. I'd rather have him than Kamala Harris or whatever. You know, who do you think is going to be? Of course, I think it's going to be Warren.
I do too.
And I think it was always going to be Warren. I think they've kept her off radar for the early months to keep her from getting dented or something. And she was polling low, and I could never understand why would Warren poll low. And I think the reason is they wanted to keep her from the attack dogs. So they let Biden take the beatings, or let Bernie take the beatings. Right. I think you're going to see a tremendous rally out of Warren, and I think the thing was planned, because as I look at that group, she's the only credible one.
Well, yeah, and she's got the fight in her. Out of all of them, I think she's probably got the most fight in her.
Too much, yeah.
And, you know, of course she would be a disaster for...
Mayor Pete could do it.
I like
this
him.
Could be like a Hillary Hillary Obama thing, where maybe they thought Hillary was the nominee and then Obama way outshined and said, okay, we can switch.
Well, I just talked to my parents about Mayor Pete the other day when they came up. And there's one thing I will say that I like about him. And if I had to vote for a Democrat that was on that stage and Tulsi wasn't on there, because I think Tulsi would probably be my first choice of the Democrats, Pete would probably be my second. Because the impression that I get from him, even though there's a lot of shit that I disagree with him on, but A, he served the country honorably, number one, which gets you points in my book. And number two, the impression that I get from him, Dave, is that when he speaks, like, for instance, somebody asks Biden a question, you can see he tries to stick to his talking points, which he can't remember, and then he goes off the deep end and it turns into a diary of the mouth and a huge disaster. When you try to get an answer from, you know, Bernie or Warren, you're getting semi-scripted stuff. What I get from Pete when he answers is, I feel like he is saying, I don't feel like he's giving scripted answers. I feel like he's giving answers off the top of his head and saying exactly how he feels, because he has given some kind of unpopular answers that aren't all the way far to the left that everybody else. I think one of them was on student debt, and I said, would you just cancel it all? And he was like, well, like, you know, let's just hang on a second here. Maybe there's a more reasonable solution or something. And I don't know. I get the impression that he speaks honestly, and that'll get you some points with me too.
Yeah, that's why I think Mayor Pete could do it. He seems like there's a voice of reason there. And so he could be the guy. Warren seems to have taken to politics too well. So the matronly person who sort of showed up on the stage as a young senator, or originally as a TARP overseer, she would sit there, and when she'd be interviewed and stuff, she'd be calm, and her statements would be measured,
right,
and she'd still have a sense of purpose. And now you watch her, and she looks like, you know, batshit crazy lady. And so I find it disturbing, because I used to really like her.
I think you make a really good point, though, what you just said before, which is that there was a group of people in 2016 that basically their argument was, if Trump gets elected, the world is going to end. And that hasn't happened. As a matter of fact,
right,
you know, we've pretty much been at peace here the entire time that he's been president. So,
yeah, better than Obama, actually.
That, I think you make a very cogent point. Some of those people might be more likely to come around, right?
Yeah.
So, anyways, all right, Dave. Well, listen, man. I want to thank you so much for coming back on with me today and taking an hour and 40 minutes for me. It's great to have you on, man, as always. And hopefully...
Yeah, well, you know, you should ask your readers if they give a damn, but...
About what?
You know, about anything, you know. Keep your eyes on the material. We ranted and raved about some pretty random topics, but...
That's what we do.
Yeah.
Dave, but, you seem to think that it's like that you're going to come on too much. And with the feedback,
well, I think
the
there's such a thing as overexposure.
Well,
yeah.
I know. You've been saying that since the first time we've gone on. The feedback I get every time you come on is, why isn't Dave Collum your permanent co-host? So I got to find a balance between the two. You know what I mean?
Well, I think there's people who want to see you return to pure finance, right? And I know you say, well, fuck that. I'm doing what I want to do, and that's fine.
That's exactly right.
But I do know that there's some incredibly incisive people that after a while I can lip sync what they're saying.
Right.
And that's overexposure.
Yeah, but what we...
Right?
What
so if I start repeating stories and repeating philosophies and repeating ideas, then it's overexposure.
But, I wanted you to come back on today because so much has happened since the last time you've been on. I mean, with Epstein dying, I wanted to talk about that. The Kavanaugh stuff was all brand new. You know, the Saudi oil stuff is all brand new. Your take on the Democratic candidates was all brand new. So, look, I promise not to beat you like a, you know, rented mule on this podcast. And let's give it a couple months and come back on and let's check it again.
I'm happy to do it. I have fun, and I've discovered that I personally like doing long format interviews because you can go till you've sort of dealt with the topic, and I also know that there's only so many you can listen to in a week or in a month, so people will turn it off fast if it's not hitting the hot button on them.
Well, and you know what? That's people's prerogative. People tell me all the time, don't have this person on.
Metrics. Do you have concrete metrics that tell you when something's really been received well?
Yes, I do. So
at some point off the show, I'd like to share them. I'd like to find out, sort of what your pings are and how you know, and even maybe have a conversation after this is over. You can tell me, who are the big ass duds and who's super popular. I got to believe Whitney really blew the socks off people.
Well, Whitney was, as a matter of fact, we can talk about it right now. I mean, I don't have anything to hide. Whitney was the first podcast I did with her was the best podcast that I've ever done by far.
In terms of stats.
Yeah, because that pulled in 63,000 on YouTube. I think.
Saw that.
And behind the scenes on the statistics that you don't see, which is your Apple podcasts and the people that listen through Podbean and all that shit, I can give you that number right now. But it was... So that one was, well, this is from August, so we need to go to all time here, and just hang tight with me for 1 second. I know you're going to say, we don't have to do this now.
I can hear the readers, the listeners hanging up as you search.
You know what? Listen, like I say, if you don't like it, fucking, you can turn it off. That's the great thing about podcasts. People say, I like it when you rant. I like it when you have this guy on. You know, I had somebody tell me last week, hey, you shouldn't have this guy on again. He's detrimental. Is it? Don't fucking listen to the podcast. Listen to the ones you like. Turn off the ones you don't like. You know, I don't listen to every Joe Rogan podcast that come out. If I see Dan Aykroyd, I want to listen to him. I listen to him. If I don't, I just fucking go listen to something else. Okay, here we go. So the number one podcast of all time on, it's a tie pretty much between the conspiracy theory one that was banned from YouTube that me and you did. That got a lot more on my platform. So that got 42,000 listens on Podbean and iTunes, etc. And then I think had somewhere between Vimeo and everything else like 15, 20,000 additional ones, but that got pulled. And the Whitney Webb one, the first one, had 18,000 here and 63. So that one's at like over 80. So that was probably the most popular podcast so far. And you were number two. So,
oh, that's amazing. So whack jobs really sell them.
No, that's it, baby. You know, it's my target demographic, baby.
Well, you know, I've told Whitney how much I think, what I think of her, her contribution to society.
Right.
And I've actually tried to help her out. I've gotten some inside information from sources I can't divulge and told her to look into it. In fact, one of the problems was it was a person. I got some information from inside an organization which if it leaked out who gave it, someone close to me would get fired. And so I just gave her a hint, and I told her some other people she could talk to. And so I've tried to help her along.
And number three, four, and five, I'll tell you right now, Richard Gage is number three on this platform. Number four is Peter Schiff, and number five is Bill Fleckenstein. So, you know.
Well, I love to listen to Bill.
I do too.
I subscribe to his site, even though I'm not a trader. And I read Tony Greer's stuff in the TG Macro, even though I'm not a trader. And those guys are traders. And there, I listen to Greer because he's just such a hoot and great with quotes too. But I listen to Bill because he basically is constantly telling his readers, calm the hell down, right?
Yeah.
Shit like this happens, you know, pull your underwear out of your ass and quit getting all wound up, you know? Silver dropped, you know, down to 17, so what, yeah. Right? And his questioners are always panicking.
Right.
although I know there's some unbelievably good people who subscribe to his site. I know some of them, and but for me, it's you know, Dr. Bill, right? And I just read his stuff every day, and sometimes I find his analyses fall short of what I thought he could have said. But he balances me out, and he says, look, nothing like this, none of this is going to matter yet. And so I have to remind myself, just because the market hiccuped or gagged or you could taste a little vomit doesn't mean anything.
Right. Silver dropped 50 cents on its way to $40.
Yeah, right. You know, if you, like he says, if you try to trade a bull market, you're going to lose. You just, you know, yeah. What's that? There's a porno thing where you grab the girl by the hair and you whisper something in her ear and then you hang on for dear life. There's a name for that. I better stay off that one. So in any event,
you're the one that sent me the message before we started the podcast that was like, let's just keep it calm.
Well, I was obtuse enough on that. Yeah, I was obtuse enough.
Let's keep it calm today. Yeah, sure, Dave. All right.
Yeah, keep it
what's
calm.
What's the thing
yeah,
in the Dave. Porno where the guy's pulling the girl's hair? He starts calling her mom. I don't know. It's very weird.
So the problem is I don't have a filter.
Oh, shit.
and I just can't control myself.
And that's why we love you. Okay, listen, we're going to give it like at least a 2-month stay of execution before I invite you back, all right?
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Unless
something really cool happens, and then we'll do some.
I'm gonna wait for you to come to me and say I'm ready.
Okay.
All right.
That works.
That's what I do. That's what I do with my Montana skeptic now. You know, I just ask him.
Yeah,
no. And then when there's something that comes up, he wants to talk about. You say, hey, you want to talk about
this? That's exactly right. So what you do is you throw hooks out there, and when the guys have something to chat about, they'll say yes.
That's it, man. Keeping it all natural, baby. Swing low, sweet chariots. All right, Mr. Colum. It was my pleasure.
Adios. Bye.
That was the one, the only Mr. Dave Colum coming in live from his underground bunker near Cornell. It's a small community college. I'm sure you've never heard of it. Somewhere in Ithaca, New York. But anyways, appreciate Mr. Colum for coming on the podcast. And also, as always, appreciate my patrons for supporting the podcast on Patreon. You guys make this freak show circus possible. And for that, I love you. But for right now, I'm the fuck out. Peace.